Hello and welcome to the first Texas Tribune Tribcast of the new year. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith, if I can get that out. Happy New Year.
Hey, Elise.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
I hope the rest of it goes better than this so far.
And Ben Philpott, who's covering the governor's race for the Tribune and KUT News based here in Austin. Hi, Ben.
Excellent. Very good job, Elise.
Our three topics today, Ross and Evan are teaming up on the slate of Democratic statewide candidates that we now are aware of. I want to talk about the transportation issue. Does it resonate in the governor's race on the Republican side? And Ben is hitting whether this Republican effort to turn the blue dot in the red state red might actually be successful.
Light blue.
Pink.
Yeah, Evan and Ross, why don't you guys take it away?
Ross, I'm interested in the outcome of the filing deadline coming and going and who the Democrats were able to recruit to run for many of these offices. I say many because certain offices, comptroller, for instance, the Democrats fielded exactly no one.
Yeah, Susan Combs got a bye.
She got a bye. She will, I guess, have a Libertarian candidate, we think.
That's right. She does have a Libertarian.
But no Democrat. And elsewhere on the ballot, you had what I would describe as Bill White and the Seven Dwarfs. You have the powerhouse at the top of the ticket running for governor. But quite frankly, the candidates drop off in gravitas significantly from the top down. Who would have imagined that the second most powerful and important and interesting and plausible candidate for statewide office this cycle would be Hector Uribe.
Or at least headline grabbing.
Headline grabbing. And, there was a Lone Star Project press release. Lone Star Project is the effort headed by Matt Angell out of Washington, the good folks who are working hard to raise money to see if they can't turn Texas back to a two-party state, if not their own one-party state. They put out a press release yesterday, as far as I'm concerned, thoroughly implausible in its enthusiasm for this slate of candidates who they pronounced the greatest thing since sliced bread. The reality is it was not a particularly good year for recruitment, I think, on their part. They did not get the big-name candidates they hoped for many of those down-ballot races. And, they may have, with Bill White at the top of the ticket, staved off complete oblivion and total disaster, but, you know.
Well, you know, to quote from the book of Rumsfeld, you go to war with the army you have. You know, the Democrats.
Yeah, how'd that work out for him?
Well, the Democrats and the Republicans got into this mindset over the last year, and frankly, so did we in the press, that Hutchison is going to resign. And that's going to start this game of musical chairs that goes all the way through the top of the ballot. David Dewhurst will run for that, and that'll open up the lieutenant governor's job. And Greg Abbott will run for that, and that'll open up the attorney general's job. You had the prospect of a bunch of these statewide positions on the ballot being open seats. The risk of running, I mean, it's easier to run for an open seat if you're a challenger or you're out of office than it is to run against an incumbent. Well, we all know what happened. Kay Hutchison didn't resign. And so the top of the ticket on the Republican side is all filled by incumbents. And the Democrats who were looking at those races, some of whom filed, some of whom didn't file, looked at the races and said, you know, I'm either running against an entrenched incumbent, which is tough, or I'm not. If you know, had Hutchison resigned, had that musical chairs thing, you know, you sort of wonder what the ballot might have looked like. I think Linda Chavez Thompson, in particular, to a lesser extent, Ronnie Earl, both of whom are running for lieutenant governor. The third Democrat running is Mark Katz, who owns an Austin deli, sort of a personality in Austin. Linda Chavez Thompson checks a couple of boxes that could be important for the Democrats as they go into this political year. She's a prominent national labor official. Labor, of course, is a really important constituency in the Democratic Party and in Democratic primaries and in Democratic primary finance. I mean, they get people on the ground, they have money, they put out signs, you know, that's valuable. She's the most prominent Latina on the ticket. I think that draws a constituency that's also important to the Democrats.
Is she not the only Latina on the ticket?
There are a couple of other people.
Is there a woman? I'm aware of Felix Alvarado and Hector Uribe.
Alvarado, Alma Aguado, who is running for, she's a San Antonio doctor who's running for governor. We suddenly ended up with seven people in the Democratic primary for governor. So there are some others. She's the one that's most likely, I would say at this point, to be on the November ticket.
Chavez Thompson.
Yeah, I'm not predicting the outcome of the Democratic primary for lieutenant governor, but of the Latinas who are running,
Ronnie
she's
Earl
the most
may bring charges
November,
against you
right.
if you keep talking
yeah,
like
right.
this.
And it could happen.
Look, the fact is, she could not be more of an anti-Dewhurst.
Right.
In all the boxes she checks, she sets up the greatest contrast to David Dewhurst that any candidate potentially could.
And she's really unabashed about it, in fact. You know, she said at her announcement on Monday here in Austin, you know, everybody's making points about how I'm a female and I'm a Latina. Well, look at me, you know? I am. I'm proud of it. That's who I am, you know, and I'm going to own it. And I'm also going to own the fact that I'm from labor.
And she has a great life story. There's no question about that. But those things do not a victorious candidacy necessarily make. And I know that I'm, you know, Harold Cook and Matt Angle will leave flaming bags of poo on my doorstep tonight for having said this.
Local but the consultants.
The reality is that I don't believe that the Democrats have fielded a slate of candidates that can win an election other than governor and probably, maybe, possibly not even that one.
I think a lot of this is environmental. I'll just say, you know, you can, you know, as they file, the Democrats are in sort of a political recession. You know, people in Texas in particular are sort of down on the Obama administration, down on the way things are going. The economy doesn't look great. The real voting for these positions is going to happen in October and November, and we don't really know what the environment is going to be at that time. These, you know, this might turn out to be a viable ticket. You know,
but viable in what sense? In other words, if you go back to 2002, when we were spoon-fed or force-fed, depending upon your perspective, the dream team. Mm-hmm. Tony Sanchez for governor, and John Sharp for lieutenant governor, and Ron Kirk for the United States Senate, and Kirk Watson for attorney general. You know, those were big brands, all aligned and arrayed in service to this idea that Texas was a competitive two-party state, and they all got their clocks cleaned. You know, famously, Tony Sanchez spent $68 million or something to get the same vote that Marty Akins did against Carol Strayhorn.
Right.
The reality is Democrats couldn't crack that base ceiling. And I think Bill White will help them immeasurably this year reach out to people where they haven't gotten votes in previous elections, and the state is less red than it used to be and all that. All those things are true. I don't deny any of that. But the reality is, as they say at the poker table, you cannot win if you do not play. And these bigger brands who are thinking, I'd like to be a statewide office holder at some point, I'd like to run some point, get off the stick or shut up. The idea that somehow these guys are waiting for an opportunity to be handed to them on a pillow with a little thin mint next to it is just crazy.
Well, in fact, you know, if the Democrats did have a bang-up year, let's just say, there's this weird, arcane legislative redistricting board. Next time the legislature meets, they do redistricting. We get the census next year. Redistricting comes in. We redraw all the political maps. If it bonks, if the House and Senate cannot agree to maps for the Texas House and Senate, it goes to this arcane five-member panel called the Legislative Redistricting Board. And the Democrats, I think the problem really with their ticket this time is that they've put themselves in a position where they basically have to sweep the table in order to be a player on redistricting. They have to win three out of these five seats: lieutenant governor, Speaker of the House, land commissioner, attorney general, and controller. They're not competing for controller.
Right, that one's out.
A couple of important Democrats have left the House, or one changed parties, Chuck Hobson, one left the House, David Farabee. Those look like they're going to be Republican seats. It becomes much, much harder in that context to win the Speaker's position. So two down out of five. So now they have to sweep the table for lieutenant governor, attorney general, and land commissioner against entrenched Republican incumbents. I think it's a very difficult thing to do, even if the Democrats have a really great year, and even if this turns out to be a better ticket than it looks like today.
Well, the attorney general's race is very hard for them. Lieutenant governor, I would argue, despite Linda Chavez Thompson being the anti-Dewhurst, is a very hard one for them. I mean, I think land commissioner is, you know, I'd put land commissioner maybe at the top of the list of those three, only because Uribe is... you know, these guys run for office before. He's a vote getter. I think there are reasons why Uribe sets up, you know, is at least competitive.
He's a vote getter to a certain extent. He got 39% against Carol Strayhorn.
To a certain extent.
For a railroad commission. And Jerry Patterson, the Republican in this thing, always fights above his weight. He's always underfinanced. He always does better than everybody thinks he's going to do it.
Right.
It's a tough race.
And he doesn't give a crap about anything. He is just, he's as unconventional as they come. He doesn't play by rules that are accepted by other folks. And that, one of the appeals about Patterson, whether you're a Republican or Democrat, is Patterson's his own guy.
Right.
Follows his own star.
You go just to see what he'll say.
You know, I think there are people out there who think that if Kinky Friedman gets past Hank Gilbert in the primary for Ag Commissioner, that Kinky Friedman versus Todd Staples might be an interesting race to watch. You know, Well, for us, but I actually think even that, you know, look, Kinky Friedman from a name ID standpoint, if this were TV, and hell, it may as well be, his Q rating is pretty high,
mm-hmm.
right? And he said, and a lot of people probably don't know Staples all that well.
I'm sure his Q rating could be high, though, too.
Who, Staples?
Yeah, I mean, he's very likable and attractive.
Well, in that respect, I mean, I'm talking to somebody from television. I shouldn't have used Q rating as a reference point here because she can beat me about the head and face. But the point is...
Let's explain how Q rating works.
But I do think that Friedman, though, presents... You know, if he were to get past Gilbert, Friedman presents in sort of an interesting way. That's not to say that Gilbert wouldn't be a competitive person. But I'm left with the feeling that it's always... We're gonna, and then filing day comes and they don't. And
I wonder if Bill White feels as if he were sold a bill of goods to join into the governor's race.
Just to play.
If you join in, this person and this person are really looking at it to move on to one of these other races.
I think those other races matter way less than Bill White's race. You know, because Kirk Watson often refers to his 2002 failed bid for attorney general as, you know. I could have said that I had the solution to the Mideast peace crisis, and if Tony Sanchez would have, you know, accidentally said a cuss word or something, I would be buried in B18 and he would be on the front page of the newspapers. So all the air is kind of sucked out for the other races by the governor's race and the lieutenant governor's race. So, you know, important, I think, for Democrats to have Bill White at the top of the ticket.
And maybe your theory is that with White at the top of the ticket, and, you know, say B to B minus candidates elsewhere on the ballot, they're likely to benefit from White being at the top of the ticket, because if White stirs up some enthusiasm, Democrats come out and vote for White, and then they vote for Democrats down the ballot. Whereas if a less interesting candidate for governor had been at the top of the ticket and better candidates on the down ballot races, those better candidates might have suffered for the presence of the top of the ticket guy?
I'm just playing contrarian here, of course.
No, I think that's a reasonable question to ask.
I think it's a little bit slower process than that. I'm not sure that you benefit that year from Bill White. You know, if Bill White runs really well, I'm not sure that the other Democrats necessarily benefit. But if he or any other Democrat gets into office, then you begin to build the base that builds the next cycle's elections and get serious candidates in it. This is what the Republicans did in 90. Perry and Hutchison got elected. Nobody else got elected. But they began to build the base as statewide office holders, upon which George Bush and everybody else started getting elected in 1994. And upon which, I guess, the Republicans began sweeping Texas executive offices or statewide offices in 1998.
Just on the topic of Republicans, that I'm just trying to find a segue here into this.
Good luck.
To my topic, which is...
You make sense of this?
Which is the state of the Republican race in terms of this ad war that's kind of getting more serious this week now that we're getting closer and getting into the sprint to the primary. Kay Bailey Hutchison is on the air with a new ad. She has picked transportation as the issue she wants to hit Governor Perry on. The campaign, the Kay Bailey Hutchison campaign, says there's indication that this is a huge weakness for Perry, and they simply need to remind voters why they're not really enamored with Perry, and that this is the issue where they can kind of be successful. There's questions as to whether this ad actually hits him in the right place and whether it's effective on that issue in that they see as a negative. But my bigger question is whether this issue resonates at all still with voters, since I don't know what percentage of voters are really concerned about toll roads and this land grab Trans-Texas corridor, and whether they even know whether what the Trans-Texas corridor is anymore.
I think there are parts of the rural areas around Dallas-Fort Worth that are quite still aware of what's going on. I mean, they were part of the land grab, and they're mighty thankful now, if the Trans-Texas corridor is actually finally dead, that it has died. And it's not going to take very much to remind them. Now, we're still talking, though, about rural county areas outside of the major metropolitan, so maybe she moves the needle a few thousand people with this, because those people have not forgotten and are still mad and still show up to Tea Party rallies with, you know, don't toll my roads.
You know, you have to do a two-step here. Politically, Hutchison is trying to get voters to either blame Perry for the traffic jam that they're in or for the price that they paid for the road. So it may be that you're mad about the traffic jam, maybe that you're mad about the toll, but the question here is, can she get those voters to the point where they transfer that anger to the governor in time for a March 2nd primary? And, you know, it hasn't worked for anybody else yet. There's a spike in Texas. If you look at geographic polling, there's an interesting spike around this in Waco, for some reason, that Carol Strayhorn tried to exploit in the last governor's race. And, you know, the votes in McLennan County looked fine, but they didn't work in the other 253 counties. So far, this issue hadn't gone. The other thing that's sort of interesting about this is at the same time that she's decrying Perry's Trans-Texas corridors and his Trans-Texas, you know, all these toll roads and everything, she's talking about high-speed rail, which was going to be the thing in the median of the quarter-mile-wide Trans-Texas corridor. It was going to have, you know, roads on the outside and then freight rail and then, you know, high-speed trains and all kinds of communications infrastructure. You know, there's a lot of dissonance in that message, I think.
I want to know whether any voter in the Republican primary is going to vote based on issues or whether they're going to vote based on ideology. My suspicion is that it's the latter more than the former. In other words, this is falling, at least up to this point, out as what we sort of thought it would, which is that who can get to the right of whom, right? And so, as you say, you know, if there's anger, Ben, on the people on the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party are mad at the governor over tolls. This is an effort potentially on Hutchinson's part to try to tap into some anger to the right of the governor.
Right.
Hard to imagine there's any room there between him and the wall, but okay. The fact is, though, I don't think that there are people out there clamoring about transportation as a big issue. Certainly in the Texas Tribune UT poll, Ross, there was no evidence that transportation had somehow shot to the top of the list.
Right. People were worried about the economy and jobs.
That's what they're worried about. And, you know, the governor was out on the stump today talking about a constitutional amendment to prevent tax increases. You know, governor understands that that's where the red meat of the party is right now, is on that issue. I think Senator Hutchinson is certainly entitled to conduct this campaign as she wishes, and she's going to choose the issues that she and her folks think are best to help her differentiate herself from the governor. But the reality is, at the end of the day, this is not about whose position on transportation is better. It's about who the voters in the primary, who will be, surprise, surprise, the rightest, most wing of the party, who do those people believe is more faithful to conservative values? And that was always going to be an uphill battle for her, and it continues to be one.
It would be interesting in a race like this, you know, just the way this thing has laid out, if there was a rich Republican in this race who was not an office holder and could run against government, I think that person might be doing very well.
You got one in mind?
No, but I'm just saying if you
because the filing deadline is passed.
If you weren't a United States senator who's getting blamed for the problems in Washington, and if you weren't a sitting Texas governor who was getting blamed for the rise in the state budget, there might be an issue here. Part of the problem here is that there may be an issue here for Republican voters in the primary, but these candidates don't offer them a choice. And actually, this is one of the places where, to the extent that she's made any headway, Deborah Medina, the third candidate in this thing, has made some headway. She's walking around talking about we should get rid of the property tax. We should get rid of these taxes. These guys have been in office too long. If someone like that had a megaphone and a bunch of money, I think, you know, you might have a different layout in this primary.
Well, she'll have at least one megaphone moment now.
Right.
She's going to be at the KERA debates. As she said all along, KERA has finally agreed that, yes, she does meet their criteria. She's got an active campaign.
What changed that their criteria suddenly permit?
I don't think their criteria changed. I think they were sitting back and waiting to make sure she did check off everything.
And when the egg on their face ran all the way down so they could see again, they changed policy on this.
Well, this is the problem with doing debates. I mean, you know, get the two campaigns, and you know, if you just sort of flatly lay this out, there's some nuances here, but we can ignore them. The Hutchinson campaign wanted Medina in there because Medina is throwing lawn darts at Rick Perry. The Perry campaign didn't want Medina in there because Medina is throwing lawn darts at Rick Perry. And so what happened was, I think the campaigns finally relinquished. You know, Hutchinson had the benefit of the outcry outside, the egg on their face. KERA right. could look at this, and Perry finally folded up. So Medina's on the thing.
Right. So who would have imagined 6 months ago that Deborah Medina would be in a debate and Paul Burka would be out? Who would have imagined that? Look, I want to stay with Medina for a second, sure, if we can, because I'm curious at this point now to ask if we are convinced that Medina is hurting Perry. See, I guess I grew up thinking that when you have an incumbent running against a challenger and a second challenger emerges, the second challenger ultimately hurts the first challenger in that the anti-incumbent vote is divided. So why are we assuming that Medina is necessarily hurting the governor? Why is she not ultimately hurting Hutchinson? Why wasn't Hutchinson the one who wanted to keep Medina out, given the fact that she wants to be seen as the only alternative to Perry?
Well, I mean, if Medina is taking away from Perry, and I think she is for this one reason. Yes, she's the Kay Bailey supporters, if you make the assumption that Kay Bailey supporters are the moderates within the Republican Party and Perry is pushing right, Medina's pushing right, it doesn't make sense that I have a hard time believing that a moderate Republican would all of a sudden decide, you know what, that Medina girl, the last time I saw her at one of those secession rallies, it really grabbed me. That's not the thought process I see happening. But, and now I don't know where the rest of my thoughts
are. But Ben, the universe
I'm
of potential.
That for the next
blooper I'm about to say, it's good to see that you're
Thank
back
you.
After yeah, the yeah. first of the year on your game. The point is here that if you assume that there are people out there in the world who are saying, I don't want to vote for Rick Perry, what are my alternatives? The fact that there's more than one alternative can't be good for the alternative who wishes to be the alternative.
I think Kay likes her being there because that Medina may be her best shot at a runoff.
Well, I'm not sure that Kay wants a runoff. I mean, you know, but go back to what you said at the very beginning of this, Evan, which was that this may be a race that's more about ideology than about anything else. And if it is, if that does turn out to be true, then Medina does take away more from the Perry ideology than she does from the Hutchison ideology. So, you know, if you believe that that's the frame that we're working in and you're Hutchison, then you want Medina in there clawing away at Perry. I don't know that it benefits Hutchison in particular to have a runoff with Perry. I think everybody in that race would like to, you know, peel this Band-Aid off really quickly, get it over
with. Except for the people that run TV and radio stations who, if Ben's reporting this week and last week is correct, they're, you know, they look like the guy in the Monopoly game with the monocle and the top hat now, because they're going to be getting $1 million a week from these campaigns. And believe you me, the campaigns are desperate to not have this money be spent. I mean, I think the Perry campaign would like nothing more than for Hutchison to blow up and go away so that they didn't have to spend $20 or $25 million defending that. Defending themselves in the primary. But, you know, the only winners in this may ultimately be the media who receive the advertising dollars.
The bright spot in the Texas economy.
It sure is. Well, when the governor talks about jobs creation, I didn't realize he was talking about it to below TV stations.
Ben, you're on deck for the third and final topic.
Well, I was just kind of curious with the filings that filing deadline, who filed.
Was going to be the bowl game.
No, go ahead. I'm not going to talk about the bowl game. Although, you know, Hutchison does have a campaign ad in the national title game. If a Hutchison campaign ad is going to make any difference, this might be the shining moment. This is where the eyes will be, and
what will happen is Mark Ingram will be distracted by a Hutchison campaign ad on the Jumbotron and will fumble. And UT will win.
All right, I will say this one time and one time only. I hope she has this ad in the first quarter, because the Texas fans will start turning it off by halftime. All right, now.
Yeah, unlike this podcast.
Ben Philpott, P-H-I-L-P-O.
Get in line behind the Kay Bailey Hutchison campaign when you leave the poo on my doorstep. So there's several Republicans that have filed for some of the offices in Central Texas, as Elise was saying earlier, Austin, Travis County, the deep blue sea in the red state of Texas. There are several very capable candidates that are running in races in the more moderate areas of Travis County, like in Donna Howard's district, like in Valinda Bolton's district, that, you know, might make it Travis County and might make the elections here locally a little more interesting. I think it's one of the more interesting ones is Donna Howard's district, where she's had no trouble defeating pretty much everyone, including a millionaire with his own money to spend to win essentially a 30-day special election race, Ben Benson. She's going to be going up against a former University of Texas offensive lineman, All-American, Dan Neal. And if there's one thing that will get people to the polls or to watch a BCS national title game, it's sticking Texas football in the middle of it. But then you also have Linda Bolton has three challengers. And she was the one Democrat in Travis County that just about lost the last time around. And that's even with excitement for President Obama on the ticket in the last time.
There was a big effort among the Republicans last time to get the Libertarian in that race out of the way. You know, the thinking here is that if you have a Democrat and a Libertarian and a Republican, and it's a very, very close race, that the Libertarian takes away from the Republican and makes it possible for the Democrat to win. So they were worried about that, and they got the Democrat out of that race. Bolton narrowly won it last time in an Obama year. They're thinking this time, this is a district that's in southwest Travis County, Austin.
And used to be Republican, yeah.
And was quite reliably Republican. And in fact, votes Republican in some other races. So their thought is that they can come back. Now, somebody, Dana Chido, who does a lot of analysis of races here in Austin, was pointing out to me the other day that that none of the seats that the Democrats pulled away from the Republicans in this last two or three cycles have reverted back to the Republicans. The Republicans still have several seats targeted this year, and we're going to be watching them to some extent in the primary, but mainly in November. But, you know, Bolton is one of these seats that the Republicans look at and just, you know, based on numbers and based on history and based on the people they know at those districts, just believe it's Republican territory that's wrongly held in their minds by a Democrat.
Republicans are going to have resources to run hard at Democratic incumbents, but not every single place. They're going to have to pick their battles. If I'm the Republican Party and I've got a certain amount of money and a certain amount of energy and time and effort to put into a race, am I going to go Maldonado or Bolton? I'm going to go Maldonado. Am I going to go Maldonado or Howard? I'm going to go Maldonado.
Right.
I mean, the fact is Howard and Bolton's districts are less reliably Democratic from a makeup standpoint than Neistat's and Rodriguez's and even Donna Dukes's. But they are still Democratic. And I think the other thing is, both Howard and Bolton have done nothing to justify being fired.
Well, part of the issue here is that Bolton and Howard have a difference from Maldonado, and that's that they've won twice. You know, if you've won once, the best chance at knocking off an incumbent is after their first term. So you see the Republicans are targeted at Carol Kent in Dallas, at Robert Miklos in Mesquite, at Diana Maldonado in Round Rock.
Right, and Christy Tebow in Houston.
Christy Tebow in Houston. And races like that where not only has a Democrat taken the seat away, Democrats do the same thing to the Republicans, by the way, where a new person has taken over the seat, the best time to beat them is before voters really know who they are. You know, if you've only been in office for 18 months now, or for a year now, actually, your name ID can't be, you know, higher than Dan Neal's, the former UT football player.
Who's on a radio station every morning here in Austin.
So that's one of the reasons why they'll target people like Maldonado and Kent and Miklos.
And, you know, then there are going to be some people like Joe Moody, who's in his first term, who has three opponents in El Paso, Republican opponents, including one whose last name is Clayburgh, as in King Ranch, meaning that resources is not going to be an issue. Another whose last name is Margot, might be the wrong Margot, in that the Adair Margot might win. D. Margot, who's run twice unsuccessfully for the legislature, is running in that primary against two fellow Republicans and ultimately running against Joe Moody. But, you know, who knows if that district's makeup is sufficient for a Republican to win, in the same way that who knows if a district's makeup is sufficient for a Republican to win, even today in Donna Howard's district. I'm curious to know, Ben, whether and to see, because we don't know, whether, in fact, any of those seats can really flip. It is true both of those seats, not just Bolton's, Ross, but also Howard's, was held not too long ago by a Republican.
Right, right. By a Republican named Susan Combs, who's now the unopposed controller.
And then ultimately Todd Baxter, right before Howard.
And just real quickly, you know, all this, we may learn some things at the end of the November election that people are going to start gathering data on this week as the census offices across the country open up.
Right.
I mean, Linda Bolton could all of a sudden win with 8% of the vote, and we may discover something demographically that showed why that happened.
Right.
A lot more on that in coming weeks. Just a parting note for you, if you have any ideas or concerns about the podcast, you can email us at podcasts@texastribune.org. On behalf of Evan, Ross, and Ben, my name is Elise. Thank you for listening.